Let me begin by asking, can someone down there tell me how you came together and how you came up with the name?
When I was a youngster in graduate school, I wanted to start an ensemble for a specific project, which was my graduate recital. I asked the people on this very stage to be in that. We were all fellow students at the Longy School of Music, and I secretly wanted it to go on forever.
It was about
15 years ago. Why doesn't someone else talk about the name?
So we thought we had something going here, and so we asked all our friends to suggest names. And we gathered all the names, and we sort of all showed up, you know, at the bar to say, like, okay, so how do we choose here? Should we first just start by saying what our favorites are from all of these? And we said, okay, sure. And it turned out Seven Times Salt was everybody's favorite. Shout out to my friend Briarly Holbrook, who grew up in this region, who came up with the name.
You've been called a Renaissance rock band. Why is that? And would you describe your music as classical or folk or a hybrid?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a false dichotomy when we talk about classical music, right? Classical music is just music that's old enough that it's been sort of enshrined by society as somehow being good. But the fact is, all music was popular music at one time. And this was the popular music of the 17th century. And we try to approach it as though it's popular music rather than classical music. Yes, we have the, you know, specialist training as early musicians who play old instruments and that sort of thing. But our approach to the music, we really try and make it sound as though it's popular music, because that's what it was. And we certainly incorporate some folk stuff too. We all have experience playing in various folk traditions. Among, you know, the four of us, we have played Irish folk music, Italian folk music, bluegrass, klezmer, various other things like that. Prog rock. Yeah, can't leave prog rock out of it. In Matt's other life. We think it's very important to make it sound sort of fresh and relevant to the audience and not in any way fussy. If you were here in the 17th century, I mean, as lovely as it is to have a polite, you know, attentive audience sitting out there, people who went to concerts in the 17th century, especially the upper class, in fact, often didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the music. They ate, they drank, they flirted, they played cards. You know, they paid attention to the music when they felt like it, much as people do at a modern rock concert. So it really hasn't been that long.
Is there a good book that you recommend about the Plymouth Colony and the people and the events that you've spoken about?
There's been a lot of research done. I guess it depends if you want to go straight back to the source. Earlier I mentioned William Bradford's writings, which are voluminous, called Of Plymouth Plantation. So you can hear about the early settlers in his own hand. There's also been, of course, a lot of modern research done. I can't think of titles off the top of my head, but I can say that you know, my experience first coming across the settlers and this music came from my time working at Plymouth Plantation, which, of course, has done decades of research now. And I'm going to go ahead and give a shout out to at least the two other former interpreters who are sitting out there. So I'm sure they can provide more on the scholarship than I can. But needless to say, it's been a very interesting journey. You know, we have this historical record of the settlers. We don't have a historical record of what they sang, dance, played. We know they liked music, but, you know, with most people not being literate at the time, we don't have a diary entry saying, oh, this morning I sang Drink and Be Merry, and then I milked my cow. We don't know that. So it's been a little bit of informed imagination on our part.
What is the single best source for your more obscure pieces? And this question was asked by a performer in the Merrimack Valley Consort. So she's probably looking for more music to play.
They come from a number of different sources. The psalm settings that we took from Ravenscroft and East, what was called the Bay Psalter, which was the first Psalter published in, or setting, which is a collection of psalm tunes and texts published in the New World. And so the Bay Psalm book is very good. for the religious music, certainly the church music of the time. The English consort music, unfortunately, you really kind of have to have an English consort to play this, although there are recorder arrangements of it out there. I would refer you to the Lute Society, the British Lute Society's website, which has put together very nice editions in modern notation of the Holmes concert. We generally play this from original notation, from 17th century notation, which is a little bit of a learning curve if you're not used to it. But if you want things that are nicely in modern notation, except for the lute parts, which are in lute tablature, you can go to the English Lute Society's arrangements of the Holmes consorts. And most of the Dutch stuffs came from a wonderful collection from about 1642 called Nemont Cabinet, or The Useful Cabinet, The Useful Collection, which was a publication in the 1640s of arrangements of popular music for people to play at home. There are 9 volumes, and they range from everything from solo pieces up to pieces for 5 or 6 people. So there are a couple of different editions of Nemont Cabinet floating out there. So that's probably what I would recommend for this music.
One question from your talk is that you said the colonists met natives who already spoke English. Any idea how they learned?
There was one who is, Tisquantum was his Wampanoag name. He's often called Squanto in historical accounts. And he had an interesting story in that he had learned. He had been taken as a slave by an English slave trader many years before, had been taken to England as a slave, in fact, escaped, and lived in England for about 8 years, during which time he learned to speak English to some extent. And then he managed to stow away on a ship that was coming back to the Plymouth area in the 1620s. That's where his people were from. He came back and found that pretty much his entire tribe, his entire clan, had died from a smallpox epidemic, and the ones that hadn't had moved on. So when he returned 8 years later, he was basically kind of a man without a country. He did sort of join up. He lived with the local Wampanoag tribe, but they were not his people. And that's the capacity that the Plymouth Colony settlers met him in, as he was sort of an adjunct to their society. He worked for them as a hunter and as a tracker and that sort of thing, and as a guide. He was very useful to the Plymouth Colony settlers because, again, he had a functional grasp of English, which shocked them when they first encountered him.
I think this goes in a larger context, that the Plymouth Colony settlers were not the first Europeans in this part of the world. They were not even the first colony. They're not the only colony of its time. They were some of the first, but so there were some other also natives who had met trappers, and so there was already some people who knew how to speak the language.
I'm trying to weave in 2 questions into my final question. So part of it is, do you members just do 7 times salt, or do you each have separate careers? And also, will your pilgrims be progressing to the Boston Early Music Festival in June of 2019? We hope so. Tackle that one.
The quick answer is yes. We have lives outside of 7 times salt. This is all to my chagrin. I firmly believe that we should have nothing else in our lives besides 7 times salt. Unfortunately, that's not the case. We can all speak for ourselves. I play guitar, I teach guitar, I play Irish folk music in a group with Karen and Dan. That's my outside life.
Outside life, oh gosh. I specialize in obscure things. I'm a Feldenkrais teacher. I teach movement. I had an injury that made me not able to play before I came to the Gamba, and the Feldenkrais method is what I did through that, so that's what I mostly do. I'm also involved in the Jewish world. I'm, you know, God willing, going to be a rabbi sometime in the next 5 or 6 years, so, you know, we all have our lives.
And the same goes for Dan and myself. We play in various traditions, both modern and historical instruments, in various styles, wherever we are needed. And we are fairly certain the answer to that final question is yes, we very much would like to bring the pilgrims to next June's Boston Early Music Festival. We are, as I mentioned earlier, we have recorded all the material for our upcoming CD. It's not yet made. We have a common problem, which is that we're still trying to raise some funds to make that happen. But if all goes as planned, there will be a CD of this very music available this fall, and we would love to bring it to the Boston Early Music Festival. So hopefully we'll see some of you there.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org and stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook.